The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. On today's show, we're going to do what we've done the last few weeks, which is to knock out a few Social Security questions. And then I know Jim's got some random other questions to include some IRA stuff. There's probably still some COVID-related distribution questions as well. Those seem to be the hot topic of the day since we're still progressing through the pandemic of 2020. I've got Jim on the phone here, so he is calling in remotely. I think he's getting used to this, and this might be the new normal moving forward. We'll have to see if he ever makes a visit back to the studio for the high-quality audio that we used to have. But, Jim, you getting used to being at home?
Well, you're making it sound like I don't go to the office at all.
Well, you don't come up here.
I don't go upstairs. No, I don't.
Into this enormous recording studio.
But apparently I heard that Bob, who recorded the podcast last week, was in the room with you with the door closed and both of you spewing your COVID air at each other.
And he's still standing upright as far as I know.
Yeah, but it hasn't been 14 days yet, so.
Yeah, we'll see.
Give him time. He'll keel over. But
I'll tell you, it's safer here than when you go pick up your supplies at Lowe's or wherever you buy your stuff.
Home Depot, but you pre-order at Home Depot online, and they bring it right out to you.
And that person has been cleaned in a clean room? All the stuff they handed you?
I'm outside. I don't mind being outside. The wind will take that poisonous COVID air. Anyways, all jokes aside, maybe one of these days I'll venture back upstairs.
Hang on 1 second. You got a bunch of static for some reason.
Oh.
Were you moving something?
Yeah, I was holding the receiver. I think I got a cheap cord. Apparently, I get the cheap technology here.
Possibly.
Is it still doing
it? No, it's fine now. Just stay in that position.
Which is hard for me to sit here and talk and not move. For that very reason, I'll probably go back upstairs into the room. But I was thinking of bringing a oscillating fan that I have. And we'll set that up in the recording studio, open up both windows, and have that fan blow the air out, and then I'll feel comfortable. You're sympathetic with that?
Yeah, or you could wear a mask. We could wear masks in here.
And then we're going to talk through a mask? It'll be all muffled and mute?
No. You see this foam thing on the microphones? It'd be the same kind of deal. People hear us fine through that. Anyway.
Well, I got N95 masks, so those things seal you in. I don't know if I want to sit there and talk through a mask. Okay. But that's one reason I'm not flying home. I don't want to sit on a plane for 4 hours with a stupid mask on. Because it fogs my glasses. So I'll be sitting on a plane with foggy glasses. I won't be able to read, won't be able to watch my iPad, and I'll be very miserable. Okay. Well, I don't think people really want to hear about... Yes. So we're going to vacillate back and forth between Social Security questions and non-Social Security questions. We're getting through that Social Security question queue. We had a boatload of questions in there. Now we just got more of a little raft full of questions. But well, actually, no, we got a heck of a lot more than I thought. All right, never mind. I thought we were getting through it, but we're not. But anyways, we're going to try to get through a couple of Social Security questions on this show and a couple of non-Social Security questions. We'll lead off, as we have for the last couple of weeks, with a Social Security question. Okay, this is from a Californian, mm-hmm. Actually a town in California I have never heard of before. But I won't mention the town, but I will mention that according to the writer, it is in beautiful wine country.
Mm. Sounds nice.
Okay, so he begins. My mother-in-law's husband died 10 years ago. My mother-in-law never claimed her Social Security benefits. She claimed his benefits after he died. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming, Chris, he means she claimed a survivor benefit.
Yes, which would be typical when her benefit wasn't as big as a survivor benefit. There'd be no reason to claim her own if it was never going to be bigger than the survivor benefit. So just guessing, but that's likely the case, that she just stepped into his shoes and received the survivor benefit ever since that time.
Or she's waiting for her benefit to go to age 70, and she's collecting something in the interim.
Since he didn't mention that, I would assume that's not the case, but that is a possibility. Those listening out there, the survivor benefit and your own retirement benefit are separate pools of money. And that is one case where you can still effectively... It's not really called filing a restricted application, but it has the same effect where you claim one and restrict your claiming just to that one benefit, in this case the survivor benefit, while your own benefit grows in the background and maybe then eventually exceeds that survivor benefit, and then you switch over to that. Essentially, you were collecting while waiting or earning those delays. I doubt that's the case in this scenario, but just for people out there that find themselves in that position, that is something you can still do.
Okay. So one of those two reasons, she started filing a survivor benefit. Mm-hmm. He continues. She got remarried about 4 years ago. Her current husband just retired, but he wants to wait to claim his own Social Security benefits in another 4 years when he turns 70. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to assume he's 66. I was wondering if he could claim a spousal benefit right now under my mother-in-law's benefits, even though she never claimed her benefit, she is claiming her deceased husband's benefit. Plus, they have only been married for 4 years. Will this matter? So do you understand what he was asking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, perfect.
So the four-year issue is not an issue. The big issue here is you cannot claim a spousal unless your spouse is collecting their own benefit, which isn't the case here. She's collecting a survivor benefit on her previously deceased spouse. Since she's still collecting it and remarried, that means she didn't remarry until after she was 60 years old. Doesn't say that, but that's implied if she's still collecting it. But just because she's collecting a benefit does not unlock the door for her current spouse to file a spousal benefit claim on her record. She's not claiming her own benefit. She's claiming her previously deceased spouse's benefit. So just because you married this person does not connect you ultimately to that person in any way. So no, he could not file a spousal benefit on her benefit right now, because it's actually not her benefit. It's her ex, like it's not really ex, but her previously deceased spouse. It's his benefit that's actually being paid. She just happens to be the recipient of said benefit. So no spousal opportunities here. Plus, he's right on the verge. We don't have his exact age when he was born. Remember, he couldn't have done it anyway as far as filing for espousal, but letting his own grow in the background unless he was born before January 2nd of 1954. So he's right on the cusp of that, since he doesn't tell, she doesn't, the writer doesn't tell us exactly when that person was born. Maybe there's not even an opportunity to do that, even if his mother-in-law was currently collecting her own benefit. So in many scenarios, you know, in a couple of reasons why he couldn't do this, the main one, though, in this case, is because she's collecting a survivor benefit, not her own.
Perfect. All right. Let's go to a non-Social Security question before advancing with another Social Security question. This one comes from an Ohioan, and it kind of has to do with an IRA question, but I can run in this in a few different directions, but we'll ask the questions, unique question, and we'll opine our answers. Says, Dear Jim and Chris, I am a do-it-yourselfer and enjoy your podcast. I'm 58 years old and have been retired for 3 years. I do like your basic strategy regarding covering your essential floor with guaranteed income from Social Security, pension, and income annuities. I feel better about this strategy after listening to your five-part series on the logic of your system. For those who don't know what he's talking about, we did that one in January, Chris, or February?
It was the end of January and bled into February, so it kind of straddles end of January, beginning of February of 2020.
Okay, and we kind of have a sixth part, even though we don't call it that, where we address taxes, and we just did that one a couple of weeks ago, right?
Right.
Okay, so he's talking about a series. The first two shows were why Chris and I believe in doing what we do, and the last three shows are how we do what we do. And then recently, a couple of weeks ago, we did one on taxes, and that was mostly by demand, almost, if you will. We had a lot of people write to us and say, hey, we like your approach. Can you talk about how you handle taxes? So that's what he's talking about there. So he says, I continue to learn a lot about retirement planning from the two of you. I now have a basic question. I have cash accounts that are not inside my IRA, 401k, or Roth IRA. They are worth approximately $300,000. I get interest income from them every year, basically like a CD. I would like to reduce my tax burden from that interest income. Can I put the money in a Roth IRA? Up to the amount of earned income we have, which I admit is not a whole lot. And then any interest in the future that is in the Roth will not be taxed. If I can do this, I also realize I should have done this longer ago when my income was much higher. I will be 59 and a half in another year or so, so I will have access without any 10% penalty. He's missing the boat on a few things here, Chris. He said, I wish I did this in the past, when I had a lot higher income. Remember, he's been retired for 3 years. You can't put money, listener, into a Roth up to your earnings. It is, if you're over the age of 50, which you are, it's $7,000 or earned income, whatever is lower. So I can maybe guess, Chris, he earns less than $7,000. But if that's the case, and he has $300,000 he's looking to shield, this is going to take a heck of a long time to get $300,000 into a Roth to save on the taxes he's paying on the interest. So do keep in mind, listener, if you do have some earned income, now you say you're retired, so I don't know how much earned income you have, and by your own admissions, you said it's basically not a whole heck of a lot of earned income that you have. Well, you will be allowed, and you are married. You do indicate you have a wife. So you would be allowed, as if you guys have earned income, if one of you is working, it doesn't take both of you, you will be allowed to put in $7,000 or earned income, whatever is lower, And then you'd be able to do the same thing for your spouse, even if he or she doesn't have a job. You would still be able to put in, now assuming they're over the age of 50, if they're under the age of 50, it's only $6,000 you can put in, or earned income. Now, do keep in mind, listener, let's just say you earn exactly $7,000. We know you're age 58, so you could put in $7,000. But you would not be able to put in another $7,000 for your spouse, assuming he or she is over the age of 50. You would have to earn $14,000 to be able to put $7,000 into a Roth for you and $7,000 into a Roth for your spouse. And if you're trying to shield $300,000, Chris, that's going to take many, many years.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. What I'm hearing in his request is really more of a how I might allocate my investments between the monies that are outside the retirement accounts, including his Roth, and those inside. If he doesn't like the fact that this $300,000 that's outside is throwing off this interest that he's then being taxed on, I mean, he might want to relook at how he has that money deployed versus money that's inside the Roth or other accounts. But he doesn't give us anywhere near the detail we would need to know about that, because we'd need to know how much he's actually using this money to live on right now, whether if it's truly not needed, then yes, he's earning interest, paying taxes on it every year, and not needing to pull it out to live upon. I don't know that, because I couldn't really, you know, can't tell from what he's questioning here.
But right.
Instead of physically moving it, you could kind of accomplish a similar thing by just repositioning what's in the Roth versus what you have outside. The only thing you couldn't do, like you're pointing out here, is physically move it into the Roth in a quick manner. There's no way you're going to just suddenly be able to move that $300,000 into the Roth, because you're limited to this $7,000 or maybe $14,000 a year contribution limit. Even if, you know, all other qualifications are checked with the earnings, etc., it'll take a long time to get that in there. Probably isn't going to accomplish what he's trying to do, but maybe there's a workaround if he just reallocates in these different buckets.
Right. That was the other thing I was going to mention. He did indicate this is his cash holding, so he may want this money liquid and safe. But if he was to refinangle some of his investments that he has in a 401k, a Roth, and an IRA, he might be able to hold his cash holdings in those accounts. Now, again, if he needs this cash to live on and he was to start taking it out of his IRA or 401k, that's going to really change his tax situation. We don't know enough about his spending needs and personal situation to tell him for sure. So I'm going to talk in generalities, Chris, but there's two other options he can consider besides trying to shield several thousand dollars a year or get several thousand dollars a year into a Roth. One of the things he can do, and you mentioned it, it would be to reallocate. And you do, I think he lists his state as Ohio. Yeah. So he lives in Ohio, so he could buy Ohio Municipal Bond Fund or an ETF or individual Ohio municipal bonds if he feels comfortable with that. Recognizing, of course, the muni bond market kind of blew up under COVID and is still exposed to a bunch of unique risks, mainly being if there's a resurgence in COVID and state tax coffers really take it on the chin, state and local tax coffers. There was little sentiment on the right side of the political aisle to bail out states that were complaining that they need a bailout as well. I personally hope we don't bail out states. I don't think people who live in fiscally sound states like Florida and Texas should have to bail out people who live in California and Illinois. But irrespective, that's my own personal belief. That said, it does open up a bunch of unique risks right now owning munis. But munis, we can't argue, Chris, could be an option for him. But if he's looking to truly have no risk, then munis don't really fit that bill because you can lose money in a muni. You do have to keep that in mind. But munis are one option. The other option, and you're probably thinking the same thing, an annuity. Now, I know that's a four-letter word for a lot of you. If you're a new podcast listener, don't stop listening because Chris and I mentioned the word annuity. If you're an existing podcast listener, you've been listening to us for a while, you know Chris and I understand annuities quite well, and they're just a tool. So he's getting interest income on this, Chris. So it's being taxed at ordinary income tax rates. That's what interest income is going to do. Well, an annuity is going to generate earnings, which will be always taxed as ordinary interest when he takes it out under his own accord. So it does afford him a little bit of flexibility. While the money is inside an annuity, no taxes will be owed. But when it comes out of the annuity, the interest has to come out first, and he'll pay income taxes on it. No different than he's getting on his interest now. It's taxed every year as income. So it's not going to change the tax structure of what he's trying to do. But while the money is inside the annuity, the money grows tax deferred, listener. You control when you take the money out. Now, what type of annuity are you going to buy? You got to be very careful here. If you buy a variable annuity that does not offer a low risk option, then your earnings could go up or down, and it's not very safe. And if you buy a variable annuity from a broker or an agent, chances are it's going to have a very long penalty period. But you could buy what is called a non-commission investment-only variable annuity. Nationwide has one. And they have a couple of very low-risk investment options, if you will. I believe one of them is a money market account, but I also believe it yields significantly below 1% right now, Chris. It doesn't yield much. But while the money is inside this annuity, in the money market account, what little interest it earns will be tax-free. And he can take it out whenever he wants. This particular
Be tax-free. It'll be tax-deferred.
It'll be tax-deferred. Excuse me. I didn't mean to say tax-free. It's tax-deferred. When he takes it out, it'll be taxable to him as interest income, which is taxed at ordinary income tax rates, just like he's experiencing now. He cannot cherry-pick and just remove his earnings. Interest always has to come out first. But what makes this Nationwide annuity pretty unique, it charges $20 a month to have it. And it will allow you to open it on Monday and close it on Tuesday. There's no penalty period. There's no rules how long this annuity needs to stay open. It's fairly straightforward.
But this type of approach is really only beneficial if he's not needing the money.
Exactly.
He's essentially saying, I want to have this kind of in this type of structure where it's earning just a little bit of interest, but it's relatively safe, if not, you know, very, very safe, which he has. He's saying it's in depository institutions like banks now with insurance, et cetera, but he's not earning a whole lot on it. But he's complaining about the taxes. But if he's needing the money and he's taking it out to use it, there's really no workaround for this. If he's needing to take the money out to live on anyway, putting it in this wrapper isn't going to really help him with anything because he isn't going to be able to defer anything because he's taking it out. But if he is receiving this interest and not needing to tap it currently to live on, then yeah, maybe finding a way to defer it, not in the Roth because you're not going to be able to shove it in there. In that case, you could shield all future growth from future taxes if you could magically get it in the Roth. But clearly, you can't just dump $300,000 in your Roth because you want to. But this deferral choice with the possible annuity wrapper is potentially beneficial if he doesn't need the money right away.
Right. And I mentioned the variable annuity from Nationwide because it's very, very flexible. Mm-hmm. But you can also get, listener, a fixed annuity. You can get a MYGA, multi-year guaranteed annuity, if you don't need the money right away. Mm-hmm. And you can get them, I think you can get them as short as a two-year term, but I know they definitely come in a three-year term.
Yeah, most are three minimum, but I think there are a few twos.
I think there are a couple of twos. And a MYGA works very similar, listener, to a CD. So let's just say you bought a three-year one. It will pay a fixed amount of interest. I think right now they pay around 2.25% up to about 3% on a three-year MIGA. And every year it'll pay the exact same amount of interest. It's guaranteed. And at the end of 3 years, they generally give you 30 days to close the annuity and take the money out. Let the annuity stay there and renew for another term, or move it to a different company's annuity. You get your choice at the end of the term. But a MIGA is completely fixed and guaranteed, and if you don't need this money right away but you want to leave it safe, that would be okay. However, if you need it during that term, the three-year term, or a two-year term if they exist, the insurance company will charge you a penalty if you access your money. So do not buy a MIGA if you need liquidity and access to this money. But that's why I recommended the other annuity, the Nationwide annuity, and use their money market and low risk option within that annuity. Even though it won't yield as much, you will remain or retain complete liquidity and access to that money. The Nationwide annuity does not impose any penalties at all when you close it. And they do not compensate the agent or broker who put you in it one red cent either. That's why a lot of agents and brokers don't talk about that annuity, because they're not going to get paid to do it. But it does have that liquidity, Chris, that he might need, that access. But he's probably going to get much lower interest rates than he would on the MIGA, which will give him much higher interest rates, relatively speaking, much higher interest rates, but you don't have access to the money.
Yeah, but last thing I'll say is don't make sure we're not letting the tax tail wag the dog.
Absolutely.
Which is, you know, you have $300,000. If somehow you're making 2% in interest on that, that's only $6,000. So, you know, the tax ramifications of $6,000 of recognized income in a year are usually not that consequential in the big picture. So make sure you're not going to go through all these gyrations and investigations and doing this, that, and the other fancy approach if it isn't really worth it. So I'd keep things in perspective and make sure you're not overly obsessed with the tax ramifications here, because it's in these low interest environments, there's just not a lot of ordinary income being generated in the form of interest on $300,000.
I agree, and I was thinking the same thing when we got that email. And this email didn't come in that long ago, so it has definitely in the time period with extremely low interest rates.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to another Social Security question. All right, this one is a little bit long. I'm going to truncate as I read this, and I will let you answer it because it's right up your alley. And this is from a listener out of, oh, they don't say, but oh well, they're from somewhere. Okay. It begins, good afternoon, Jim and Chris. I'm desperate to find out a correct answer to a question that I continue to get conflicting information on. My husband and I have listened to your podcast regularly, and I got to switch to the next page. It's printed out on two pages. It's long. And we would like to consult with you on this question. It is my, well, they begin with, I am 62 and have recently been downsized and will not be going back to work. But I don't want to draw my Social Security until I was 70. My husband is 66 and a half and still working, and he was going to wait to 70 as well. It's my understanding that there is a loophole in Social Security. This kind of ties into the last question. My understanding is that there is a loophole in Social Security based on our ages and birthdays. My husband was born September 1953. I was born May 1958. Do you see where I think we're going to go with this, Chris?
Yeah, it's not likely to be a good answer for them, but I see where this is going.
Right. So they're wondering about the loophole that you, not really a loophole, it used to be the rule, it's just that they got rid of it, that you just talked about. And in the first Social Security question that we had two questions ago. All right. It is my understanding that there is a loophole in Social Security based on our ages and birthdays that would allow me to file at age 62, which is next month, and my husband to file against mine, which I believe is called an auxiliary or spousal benefit, and not have to file against his until he reaches age 70 and can draw the highest amount. Obviously, though, if I file at age 62 instead of waiting to age 70, remember, that's what she wanted to wait to, my lifetime benefits will be lower. And she figured it out, and she writes, if I live past my mid-70s, so she thinks the break-even period is her mid-70s. Not quite sure if her math would be right on that or not, but it could be. However, if my husband can file against my Social Security and collect while waiting to collect his, it will make our lifetime benefits combined much higher. So here's what I'm unsure about. And I continue to get conflicting information from Social Security themselves. My current benefit at age 62 is $1,400. I have been told that my husband can collect based upon my full retirement age benefit, even if I file early. Had I waited to draw my full retirement age benefit, I would receive $1,900 a month. My husband can withdraw 50% or receive 50% of my full retirement benefit. That will be about $980 instead of 50% of my age 62 amount, which would be $700. One person at Social Security said my husband can only claim 50% of what I'm receiving. But another person said he can withdraw 50% of my full retirement benefit when he turns 66 and 8 months, his full retirement age. Obviously, there's a difference between those two figures, and I am wondering if you can help us.
The second person is correct in this particular case. The spousal benefit amount is based upon the full retirement age benefit of the person who has claimed. So even though she will be claiming at 62 and reducing her benefit to the 1400 versus the roughly 1900, he is over his full retirement age. I don't know where this 66 and 8 months comes from, because born in 1953, his full retirement age is 66, full stop.
Let me go back to that sentence and see.
It isn't until 1955.
Oh, and that's her. Okay, I apologize. Her full retirement age is 66 and 8 months.
Okay. First of all, they don't have to wait for that. That has nothing to do with the spousal benefit here. As long as he has reached his full retirement age and she has claimed her own benefit, even though it's early, that unlocks the door for him to collect half of her full retirement age benefit, or PIA is what we call that. So that 900 and some dollar amount you mentioned is correct. The first person was wrong. The spousal benefit isn't half of what you're collecting. It starts at half of the PIA, and then if your husband was below full retirement age, that would reduce the benefit. So there is an early claiming that reduces a spousal benefit, but it's not the early claiming of the retirement benefit recipient, in this case her. It isn't the fact that she claimed early that reduces a spousal benefit. It's as if he were to claim early. Well, he's not claiming early because he's over his full retirement age already at 66 and a half. So he also can take advantage of the, quote, loophole that she mentioned, which is to file a restricted application claiming only the spousal benefit of her numbers, the 980 per month, still letting his own benefit grow until 70 when he would switch to his now maximized benefit. He can do that because he was born before January 2nd of 1954. September of 1953 is before that date. So he's part of that grandfathered group that is allowed to still do this. A lot of people at Social Security that you talk to are fairly new or inexperienced and may give you some resistance on this, but he absolutely can do this. The only key is you must file first. That's always the first step in order to enable a spousal benefit. The spousal benefit can only be claimed if the person upon whose record you're claiming has claimed their own retirement benefit first. So she was right. She would have to file her own. She's only 62, so it would be early, permanently reducing her own benefit. But because of this loophole, they are going to get paid for him to wait. They're going to get that extra $980 until 70. They'll at least maximize one of the two benefits, but the only time this would come back to maybe haunt them is if both lived an exceptionally long period of time. Because she is permanently reducing her benefit, eventually they will be penalized through those long-term full, those permanent reductions that she's incurred by claiming at 62, will overcome the benefit of him getting the 980 per month and her getting the 1400. It'll take a while. So that's why I'm saying the mathematically, the only time this would be a bad idea would be if they both end up living a very long time, which is possible. But if they're, you know, statistically, this is usually a pretty good option to consider. So she's not asking me an opinion of whether I should or whether they should or shouldn't do this. She's just asking, could they do this? Yes, they can. The second person that you talk to at Social Security is correct, not the first person. So, yeah, if you want to do this, you absolutely can do it. You claim, he claims a restricted application immediately, delaying his own. When he turns his on, the 980 will stop, and then he'll collect his age 70 benefit at that point. You'll be getting your 1400. He'll be getting his maximized age 70 benefit, whatever that is. I didn't write it down, so I don't think you read it in the email, Jim. In the meantime, it is a way to for you to collect 1400 and him to get the 980. Those are the numbers you gave. So you absolutely can do this.
Excellent. Okay. Next question is an IRA question. A little bit of confusion going on here in this IRA question, but we'll get to it. Again, I'm not quite sure what state this person's in, but it begins. Hi, Jim. I hope you are well. Totally blew you off on this one.
Yeah.
But I'll
have
add
to sit
your name.
Quietly when you speak.
No. Hi, Jim and Chris. I hope you are well. I have a question which could be used on your show. I have roughly $80,000 of basis inside my $1 million IRA at Vanguard. Go figure, Chris, a listener to our podcast with their money at Vanguard. And I say that tongue-in-cheek right. In case people
sometimes I think there's
realize.
A link to our podcast on the Vanguard site,
even
though I know there's
should.
Not.
Okay, I have roughly $80,000 of basis in my $1 million IRA at Vanguard. My employer 401k plan allows transfers in and will also allow for Roth 401k conversions. So he's saying he's working, folks. He has a 401k that will accept money, and most 401ks do accept money, but he has a 401k that will allow transfers into it. And once the money is in the 401k, his employer also offers the ability to do Roth 401k conversions, which not all 401ks allow. They may have a Roth option, but they don't allow Roth conversions. The federal government's TSP is one of such plans. They don't allow Roth TSP conversions, even though they have a Roth TSP option.
Right.
That part makes sense so far?
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to, quote-unquote, clean my account. But the problem is, by rule, I must transfer my entire IRA. So before I go on, because he doesn't get very involved in this part of the question, folks, I want to make sure you understand what he's referencing. There is a way to, Chris and I call it, separate the cream from the coffee. Here is a person, listeners, who has a $1 million IRA at Vanguard. He has a 401k at work that will accept transfers in. But inside his inside his IRA at Vanguard is $80,000 of after-tax money, what he calls basis. What it is, folks, is money that he either put into the IRA over the years and never deducted on his taxes, or it's money that he transferred over from old 401ks that was also never deducted on his taxes. But there are reasons why people put after-tax money into their IRA. So Chris and I call that the visual we like to give you. Let's just pretend his huge IRA is a big cup of black coffee, and he just poured one of those little mini moo creamers. You know what I'm talking about, Chris? Those little foil top mini moo creamers. That's the $80,000 of after tax basis, folks. Just got poured into this massive, near $920,000 IRA with black coffee, all pre-tax money. What happens when that little mini-moo of $80,000, which brings his IRA to $1 million, Chris, that $80,000 mini-moo gets poured into a $920,000 cup of black coffee?
It all turns a little less black, and it's got cream mixed throughout. And then imagine the difficulty is, imagine trying to take just the cream back out of there. It doesn't work, right? It's all mixed together. And this is a perfect metaphor because by rule, as you take money out of that IRA in the future, it's going to come out mixed together. It's called the pro rata rule. It's going to come out cream and coffee mixed together in those proportions.
Absolutely.
And you may not want that to happen. So you may want to have them separated, which sounds very difficult. It is, but there are potential opportunities, particularly in a case like this. He has got the perfect setup to be able to do this. He has a tool at his disposal to separate the cream and the coffee.
Right. But I'll continue because he's getting a little confused. He knows he's onto something here, but he doesn't quite get it. You'll pick up on this in a second when I finish his email. So he writes, the problem by rule, I must transfer my entire IRA. And he is correct. And let's just say he had this $1 million IRA at Vanguard, Chris, another $1 million IRA at, say, Fidelity, and I'm trying to think of who else do-it-yourselfers use, another $1 million at TD Ameritrade. So he's got $3 million in an IRA. How much money does he have to move over to his 401k if that was the case? All three of his IRAs?
Yeah, he's got it's all mixed. Sorry, I was drinking some coffee. Speaking of coffee,
you were drinking coffee?
Believe it or not, I've been weeks without any coffee. I've got a nice mocha here. It was kind of chilly up here in Fort Collins today when I came to work, so I got myself a mocha. Anyway, the IRS considers all your IRAs one big IRA. So even though you hold it at different custodians, in the eyes of the IRS, it's all one big pot of coffee, and you've got that little cream in there too. So
exactly. So he kind of knows that because he says, the problem is I must transfer my entire IRA. And he's right, folks, because you got to understand, how do you separate the cream from the coffee? Well, by law, the only money that a 401k can accept is pre-tax money. Never can it accept as a transfer in, never can it accept post-tax basis. So he's thinking, I have to move my entire $1 million IRA over, but it really wouldn't be the full million, Chris. It would be $920,000 of black coffee, and magically, that little mini-moo worth of cream. Basis never changes, folks, until you start taking money out. That little $80,000 of mini-moo basis is the only thing remaining in his IRA.
Right. It gets rejected by the 401k. This is what does the separation. This magical, it's not magic, but it's this tool that pushes the cream back as the transfer tries to come in. They accept just the black coffee, the pre-tax money, and reject the cream, leaving the cream by itself back in the IRA.
And that's how you can separate basis out. But he writes, I have a very nice bond ladder inside my IRA, and I would have to liquidate that ladder as only cash can be transferred over to my 401k. And that doesn't surprise me at all, folks. Most 401ks won't accept anything but cash at transfer. They won't accept assets coming from the IRA. I don't think tax simplification would justify the destruction of my bond ladder. But I have come up with a possible solution I want to run by you. How about I create a second IRA at Vanguard? I already kind of gave away
the answer here.
Possible solution. How about I create a second IRA at Vanguard and fund it with just my $80,000 of basis? And that would leave my main IRA, we'll call IRA number two, remaining. And I will transfer that IRA to my 401k and tell them that it is all after-tax money. I think he meant pre-tax money, not because it won't accept after-tax money. Fidelity holds his 401k. Fidelity has told me they will take my word. And then I will be able to,
He meant after-tax money, and then they'll just reject all of it. They'll say, no, you can't. But the
let me back up here, Chris, because I thought I knew what he was proposing to do.
It still won't work,
but his strategy really won't work. Yeah. Let's talk to our listeners about what we thought he was trying to do. And I misread his email until I just reread it again. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Fidelity told you what? So let me back up on this. What he thinks he can do, listeners, is just selectively create another IRA at Vanguard and move just his $80,000 of after-tax basis into it.
Yeah, and let's pause there. If you were able to do that, you wouldn't have to monkey around with the 401k at all. You could separate it like that and then just convert it immediately over to the Roth and you'd be good to go.
So you can't do it because it's cream inside coffee, yeah, folks. So you aren't allowed, due to what is called the pro rata rule, to just selectively move the $80,000 into the second IRA. If he moves $80,000, there's going to be a lot of pre-tax black coffee and a little bit of mini-moo cream in that IRA.
And even
IRA.
If he did, remember, it's all still considered one big IRA. So it doesn't matter how he cuts it up. It's still one big one.
That's the other problem with this. So he's running into the pro rata rule, folks. He won't be able to separate cream from coffee that way. The only way to separate it is to send it through the centrifuge. What's the centrifuge? Send it to a 401k. That's not going to be allowed to accept the after-tax money. Yeah. He doesn't want to get rid of his bond ladder, so he wants to send the $80,000 of after-tax basis to this other IRA and leave. I'm guessing his IRA is predominantly bond ladder. Leave that nice bond ladder that he has inside the IRA. Isn't going to work.
Nope.
Pro rata rule. Second reason it isn't going to work, all your IRAs are considered one. But the third reason it isn't going to work, and very bad information from Fidelity, he apparently talked to Fidelity and said, I want to send over to you after-tax basis. And he's saying Fidelity says they will take my word for it. And he then thinks he can convert that when it gets to the 401k into a Roth and owe no taxes. I really hope the Fidelity rep didn't tell him that, because they're not allowed by law to accept after-tax dollars into a 401k. I'm assuming this would have been rejected if he did get this bad advice from some Fidelity rep and he actually goes to send it over. In fact, most transfers into a 401k, Chris, if you read the form, you have to certify you are only transferring pre-tax money, not post-tax money. So it would have most likely been squashed there. But his thought of separating this $80,000 out of his bond ladder and then just moving that after-tax money into his 401k, certifying to Fidelity that it's all after-tax money, and then immediately converting it to a Roth at Fidelity's 401k would have never happened. I mean, that is wrong on so many levels. The 401k cannot accept after-tax dollars, and the pro rata rule wouldn't allow it. So I think he got some bad information from Fidelity.
Yeah, he's kind of painted himself into a corner with his bond ladder. But again, let's keep perspective here. It's only $80,000. It's only a little bit of mini-moo in there. It's not the end of the world. So don't. I mean, he seems to be very worried about it. In the grand scheme of things, would it be nicer and more convenient to get it out that way? Yes, but again, it's predominantly going to be traditional money in this thing, and only just a little bit of that cream in there. So at least in this particular case, he's not going to be able to do it if he wants to retain his bond ladder in that IRA.
Exactly. And one thing you can do, folks, though, if this strategy does work, he just was describing it wrong, but it does work if you're not hooked on the investments inside your IRA. If you just had regular old index funds or just regular old investments inside your IRA and not a unique bond ladder, and you can replicate something similarly to the 401k, inside the 401k rather, then he absolutely could have moved that money in, separated it, and moved it back out. In fact, what we sometimes have done for people, or at least recommended people do themselves, is in the year of retirement, Chris, right before, let's just say you're going to retire at the, it works best if you're going to retire at the end of the year, December 31st, we would tell our or I would tell people, right before you retire, end of December, transfer your IRA into the 401k. Assuming, again, you don't have this wonderful bond ladder and you don't mind being out of your IRA investments for a little while, you transfer the money in December so you can keep them inside your IRA invested the way you want. But in December, Chris, you transfer the money into the 401k. You can reinvest it right away or leave it in cash. This isn't going to take long, especially if you do it towards the end of December. And the $80,000, assuming you moved all your IRAs, Chris, you agree with me the $80,000 of basis is remaining, correct?
Right. We get left behind in the IRA.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Now, you got to give yourself enough time in December. Don't do it the very last week of December. But the pro rata rule on conversions applies on December 31st, folks. This is what people don't understand. The IRS will look at your IRA balances on December 31st. So if you were to do this December 1st, and let's say it gets transferred to the 401k, Chris, by December 10th. I'm just making these dates up. So on December 10th, all the money from your IRA is in the 401k, and the only thing remaining is $80,000 of basis. Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Now you convert that money. The only thing in there is $80,000 of basis. You convert the money on December 11th. It enters your 401k, your Roth IRA, December 12th. So the conversion happens right in December. Now, if you were to move your money, if you were to retire then and then move your money back into your an IRA, you just want it out of the 401k, the IRS is going to apply the pro rata rule because they're going to look at December 31st and say, how much money did you have in your IRAs? We're going to apply the pro rata rule to that.
Yeah, so what Jim's describing is just a timing issue. That,
exactly.
That if you get too anxious and you roll it back out into the IRA immediately, all in the same year that this is going on, you could undermine your ability to separate that cream and coffee. And ideally, then you wait until January to roll that back in, and then it's all clean. And okay. since you timed it December to January, you can kind of do this without being kind of out and worry about reinvesting it very quickly and all that kind of stuff. It just makes it nice and clean doing it that way and not undermining the cream coffee separation.
Exactly. You can still retire. In my mm-hmm. example, December 12th, you retire. Yep. The conversion happened December 11th. You can retire on December 11th if you want it. The key is, don't move the money from the 401k back to your IRAs and manage it like you guys like to do. Don't move it until the following tax year. So right. move it January 2nd of yep. the following tax year. So it's just the timing. You don't know how many times I have seen in my career, I would say probably less than 10, but it has happened, Chris, where people describe this to me and they did it both steps in the same year.
Yeah, and it undermined the separation, essentially. They just poured the cream back together in the coffee is what they
exactly.
did.
Exactly. Yeah. So you separated the cream from coffee, and then you poured the coffee and cream right back together again.
Right, exactly.
So what you got to do is do it over two tax years. But a lot of you do-it-yourselfers are loath to put your money into your 401k. And I can't blame you for that if the investments aren't that good inside your 401k or you're really in love with your Vanguard holdings and your 401k doesn't offer them. You don't want to do that. And that's fine. That's why I say just wait to December. Get the money moved in there into December. Give yourself enough time to do the conversion in December. And the reason I tell you to do it early in the month and not late in the month, most IRA custodians can't promise you after December 15th that conversions will actually happen for that tax year. So you do want to recognize everyone and their uncle in the end of December and is trying to do things, and you throw in people taking time off for holidays, so custodians are understaffed, and the holidays themselves of Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, things don't happen, Chris, at a breakneck pace. That time of year. So do it all at the beginning of December, but watch the timing. That's probably the biggest mistake people make on this. They separate the cream, the coffee from the cream. They're left with just cream. They convert it, and then they're so anxious, they move the 401k back and think they did it. You got to wait till the following year.
Yep.
Okay. Right. Last Social Security question. I said we would get to three today. This is a very short question. Probably one of the shortest Social Security questions we've ever received. It is from a Pennsylvanian, so maybe Pennsylvania people are very pithy like yours truly. And it begins, hi, I would like to increase my federal Social Security withholding tax amount. I guess they want to know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. That was it?
That's the question.
Okay. Well, that is something you can do, and quite easily, actually. What you need is form W-4V. V stands for voluntary. People are familiar with their W-4s, right? W-4 is how you tell your employer your status so that they can withhold the correct amount from your earnings, but you can also withhold taxes from your Social Security. People may not realize that. And so you tell the Social Security office how much you want to voluntarily withhold. There isn't mandatory withholdings. It's a voluntary withholdings. And the form is W-4V, as in Victor. You can download the form right from the IRS, or even the Social Security website has this. If you search for it, it's pretty easy to find. And when you complete the form, you have to pick a percentage, and this is a little strange. With a normal W-4, you can tell your employer to withhold a certain dollar amount extra above the mandatory withholdings. And so you have pretty much total control over it. With the W-4V, you only have four choices. You can choose them to withhold 7%, 10%, 12%, or 22% from your monthly benefit. You can't just specify a dollar amount or any random percentage. You have to pick one of the four. Apparently, their computer can't handle anything more than just four choices. Just to simplify things, they chose those four, 7, 10, 12, or 22, and you fill that out, and then you can just drop it off at your local Social Security office or mail it in or get that back to Social Security, and they will start withholding from your benefit either 7, 10, 12, or 22%. So, again, all that you need is W-4-V, as in Victor, in order to change the withholding on your Social Security benefits. So fairly short. My answer was a lot longer than the question, but pretty short answer. And that puts us right about an hour. If you want to stop here, if you want to squeeze one more short one in, we probably can.
It's up to you. Do you want to try one? Okay, we'll do this one. This one. I don't think we answered this one yet. We might have answered one similar to this recently. Stop me if this sounds familiar, but it is an IRA-related question. Usually I pull these out of my stack of stuff. It has to do with QCDs. Didn't we answer a question on QCDs recently?
If it was a waiver of the RMDs and then timing of the QCD, then yes, we did this one.
Nope, this is similar but different question. Okay. This is not really sure where he's from, but he says, I hope you are enjoying the beautiful Colorado scenery during the pandemic. This email came in a couple of months ago, as you can tell. I will turn 60 this August, and I have been retired for a couple of years. My wife is 58, still working. We are living very comfortably on her income. We have a post-pandemic decline in net worth of roughly $4 million. I would assume a lot of that has been recouped because the market, NASDAQ recently hit another all-time high. So market is recouping, although very narrowly. We may talk about that on a future podcast. Very, very narrow market advance, so people better be careful. Okay, over the past couple of years, I've been converting portions of each of our traditional IRAs to our Roth IRAs, and I plan to continue to do this. But my wife is on the board of a local charitable organization. My question is this. Could I make a QCD from my IRA without triggering my RMDs? Or does the act of taking any type of distribution from my IRA start my RMD clock? If I can take QCDs, what type of paper trail is needed to pacify the IRS in order for it to be treated as a QCD? He's got a lot of moving parts here, and he's kind of wrong on a few things.
Yeah, it's a fairly straightforward answer, actually. He's missing one key element about when you can take a QCD.
Exactly. So let's back up to this, folks. He's 60. Well, actually, he's 59. He won't turn 60 until August.
Right.
His wife is serving on the board of a local charitable organization, and he wants to make a QCD to that charity. Keep in mind, folks, QCD stands for Qualified Charitable Distribution. It allows an IRA owner to take money from their IRA and directly send it from the IRA. You cannot receive it first and then send it to the charitable organization. It must go directly from the IRA, but it goes directly from the IRA to the charitable organization. That money will not need to be declared as income for the year that it was distributed out to the charity. So it's not going to push you into a higher tax bracket. It's not going to cause any of the ancillary tax items that happen as your income rises. It's never even declared on your 1040 as income. So it's a wonderful tax planning strategy. The problem is you must be 70 and a half to do a QCD. You're only 59, listener. You're not going to be 60 until August. You're a decade too soon. You're a little bit more than a decade too soon. So you have to wait until you're 70 and a half. then you can do a QCD. Now, that's going to be 10, almost 11 years from now, and QCDs may not be around. So don't rely on this answer in 11 years that you can do it. Make sure of the rules. But the other thing to keep in mind, and it did throw Chris a little red flag up for me, his wife is on the board of that charitable organization. He wants to know, what paper trail do I have to do to keep this copacetic? What do I have to do to prove to the IRS I did a QCD? Well, one of the big things is you cannot receive anything of value. If your wife is serving on the board of this charitable organization, and maybe her serving on the board is tied to the charitable giving that you're giving that charity, or the IRS takes that stance, you might run into a problem there. Just make sure your wife receives no special favors because of your charitable donation. Now, granted, you can't do this right now, but I'm just sharing with you that if you do get to the point where you can do a QCD and your wife is still on that board, you better make sure she doesn't receive anything of value after you do the QCD. Or the IRS, if you were ever audited, might try, Chris, to say, hey, that item of value was received and it blows up the QCD. And now the QCD is going to be taxable to you.
Yeah, just a quick reminder for people who want to know why you'd want to do this, why QCDs are so attractive, is that if you want to make this charitable donation and not have to take a distribution first and then make a charitable donation and hope that you can write off that charitable donation, which you may not be able to do under current tax laws, this ensures that you will get the benefits of the tax-free transfer by doing it as a direct transfer via the QCD. He could do this now, but he's going to have to take he can't do a QCD, but he could get money to the charity now by taking a distribution from his IRA and then donating it to the charity. But then you've got, you know, he's possibly going to put himself in a position where he's not able to deduct the charitable donation, depending on how he's filling out his tax return every single year and whether he is itemizing, et cetera, and some of these new rules, which I wish Bob was here, he could clarify some of those things. But that's why people like to do this direct transfer, because then they don't have to worry about the potential deductibility or not of the charitable donation in the first place. It kind of avoids the distribution, you know, the in and out and the accounting of all that. It's just nice and clean, no tax ramifications. The charity ends up getting it 100% without any taxes ever been paid on it. That's why people want to do this, for people out there wondering what's the attraction to the QCDs. And then there's a little side benefit in that QCD, when you're allowed to make one, will partly satisfy or fully satisfy, depending on the amount, the RMD you might be required to take that year. So that's why people are interested in doing this, if you weren't sure.
And that's the only other thing I wanted to wrap up on that. He's getting a little confused. He says, remember when he asked, could I make a QCD from my IRA without triggering RMDs? Or does the act of taking any distribution begin my RMD clock? No. Distributions, whether it's a QCD or a regular distribution, does not trigger your RMD clock.
Right.
What does trigger his RMD clock, Chris?
His age.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. 72. The law has been changed. Used to be 70 and a half for a wicked long time, but they just recently changed it to age 72. So only after reaching age 72 does your required minimum distribution clock begin.
Which, strangely enough, the QCD age was left at 70 and a half. So you could actually make QCDs before you've reached RMD age now.
Exactly. And under the old rule, you had to be exactly at your RMD age in order to do a QCD. So don't worry, QCDs, when you are allowed to do them, and right now you're not, but when you are allowed to do them, at least under current rules, listener, will not trigger your RMDs. So don't worry about that. As far as other listeners, because he did ask what type of documentation, Most QCDs are done by contacting your custodian, requesting your custodian send the check from your IRA directly to the charity, and the custodian will take the charitable information and take your information, and they will send the check to the charity. Most custodians will include a cover letter. They're not just going to mail a check, identifying it as a QCD, saying who it came from. And that letter can act as proof if you're ever audited. We prefer, a lot of times, that what we try to have people do is have check writing turned on in your IRA. A lot of custodians will allow check writing, some limit it to only when you reach your RMD age, which is now 70 and a half. Other custodians, 72, excuse me. Other custodians allow it at any age, so you have to check with your IRA custodian. But many will allow check writing on your IRA. And you can write a check, sign it, and mail it or hand deliver it directly to the charity yourself. And if you want any type of documentation, you simply ask them to send you a letter back identifying this as a QCD, or you just include your own cover letter, much like custodians do, with your check identifying this as a QCD and specifying in the letter you do not want to receive anything of value in receipt of this money, and save a copy of that and you'll be good to go.
Perfect. So that brings us to the end of another show where we knocked out six questions, even though we had a little technical disruption in the middle. But
yeah, we probably would have got through nine if we didn't have that problem.
So we had six of them. So anything else you want to say before we wrap up, Jim?
Nope. It's just been a pleasure again, folks, answering your questions. Chris is going to give you some information on how to work with us if you'd like to, and how to get us questions if you'd like to try to have us answer them on the podcast. We can't possibly get to every single question because we get quite a bit, but we try our hardest to get through anywhere between four and seven every week. We've yet to hit eight. I'm hoping we can get to eight questions one day. That'll be a new record. And anyways, Chris will fill you guys all in on that, and I will talk to you guys again next week.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Bye.
Like Jim said, we really appreciate everybody listening and sending in these questions. We wouldn't have a show without these questions. And if you'd like to send us some questions, jimhelps.com is the website. On there is a contact form. That's jimhelps.com. You can find a little more about us on there, read about what we do, send in your questions if you'd like us to add you to the queue of questions that we're answering here on the show. We do all the show answers for free. If you'd like to hire us to do things, we are doing certain things right now. Those of you who have been longtime listeners know that in our full retirement planning process, we are on kind of a pause right now. That pause is continuing, but we are looking, you know, we've got, I think, a light at the end of the tunnel here, and we will likely be taking on new folks into our retirement planning process towards the beginning of the fourth quarter, so this fall sometime. So this should hopefully have been a single instance of pausing over time. Now we've got new resources in place, but if you have been waiting to go through our full-blown retirement planning process, that is still technically on pause. We're working through the people that we already have engaged with at this point, but we're getting those done faster and faster all the time. But other things that we do, if you have tax-specific questions, we do have some bandwidth to handle some of those things. We've also got, if you've got some investment-related or asset allocation types of questions, we can certainly help you with some of those things. Or if you've got some annuities you either have or are interested in and want some unbiased opinions about what you have, what you can do with them, what might be a potential for something you're looking at, we can do those types of one-off analysis activities as well still. So it's really just the full-blown retirement planning process that's currently on pause. So with that being said, we do appreciate everybody listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.